From the land of Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 25th day of March, 2021. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Matt Bennett at agmarket.net. No update of the agricultural weather forecast. Mike Tenor is out of the office this afternoon. However, we will hear an excerpt from the half-hour press conference that U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack held with members of the National Association of Farm Broadcasting yesterday afternoon. It should be a good listen. Stay with us on this Thursday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
May corn today in Chicago at $5.46.5, 6¾ lower. December there at $4.65.5, down 3½. And that July contract, by the way, at $5.32.5 was 4¾ lower. May soybeans at $14.14¼ a bushel, 18½ lower. July off 16½ at $14.04.5. And November futures in the beans were down 13½ at $12.14¾. Bean meal up $3.60, and the bean oil futures $2.50 lower. July wheat futures, the harvest month at 608.5 for the soft red, down 10¼, and the hard red July finished at 573, 9¼ cents lower. Live cattle futures, $119.55, 42½ higher. Feeders at 144, 22½, $1.77½ higher. And lean hogs on the day at $99.67½, up $1.90. Crude oil at $58.54 a barrel, with that big stuck Suez Canal is down $2.70. Matt Bennett from agmarket.net now joins us to discuss what happened in Chicago. Matt, why don't you take me through the trade overnight and day trade today?
Well, you know, it's a little easier tone on the overnight. I think everyone knew that these huge corn sales were going to get posted this week, that we saw last week, you know, on the morning runs. And so you get over 4 million tons of corn sales. And obviously the trade wasn't overly impressed. It already kind of knew those were baked in. You know, I think a couple things are going on, a little bit of a stronger dollar situation. You know, I think there's a fair amount of talk about big acres for next week. But, you know, it's planting intentions. We always expect to see, you know, some surprises out of that. But I always remind people it's intentions. So trade definitely felt pretty heavy here today, especially on soybeans. But, you know, at the same time, it seems like we're still kind of in a chop action, at least into the report. And then maybe the trade will get a little bit better idea of kind of how it wants to go, both corn and beans.
Are you fearful that the trade hasn't fully anticipated at this point new crop or turned its attention there, simply because demand has been so good and it seems so much as if old crop is in short supply?
Yeah, I don't know that I'm fearful on that. I mean, in all honesty, I think, you know, when you stop and think about what your carry-in numbers are going to be, or this year's carry-out, you know, for new crop, you have a tough time painting a super bearish picture. And so, you know, yeah, if you have 95 million acres or more, there's no doubt that you can get yourself back over 2 billion, but using the USDA Outlook Forum's numbers, you know, if we use a little bit lower carryout number for this marketing year, which I think is a foregone conclusion given the kind of export business we've seen of late, you know, right now my team's using, you know, like a 1.25 to 1.3 carryout. So if you plug that into next year's balance sheet, even with 94, 95 million acres, if you're using the Outlook Forum's numbers for demand, you're still going to struggle to get up to and over 2 billion bushels on the carryout. So, you know, I don't know that I want to get overly bearish just yet, because you're making a lot of assumptions that, hey, we're going to have a lot of acres this year and a pretty salty yield. And, you know, if you have anything but those two things happen, there's no question in my mind that you're going to see the trade react, you know, fairly swift over the summer months.
Do you suppose that for the grain stocks, both the ethanol demand or grind and livestock consumption will support a fairly good sized usage this last quarter?
Yeah, I think this appearance is going to be pretty solid. If I was going to handicap the report or try to outguess it, if you will, I'd probably think that you're going to have a friendly number when it comes to old crop. And then whenever you're looking at a new crop, so, you know, quarterly stocks, a little bit more of a friendly feel. But as far as new crops concerned or acreage, I've got to think we're going to have big acreage numbers. I just don't see how the producer would not be in the mentality as of March 1st of a fence row to fence row type situation, given the fact profit margins, profitability, heck, crop insurance revenue, guarantees. I mean, all of the above looking really, really good. Best we've seen since, you know, back in the 2013-2014 time frame.
This report is due out, the grain stocks and prospective plantings, at 11 o'clock on Wednesday of next week. That's the 31st. Do you have a stake in the ground where you think producers ought to have new crop sales?
Yeah, I mean, I think we ought to be at least a third sold here. Obviously, if you're aggressive on crop insurance, it's going to cost you an arm and a leg this year. But if you're aggressive on it, you've got a pretty decent amount of bushels at least protected. And so I guess from my vantage point, I don't need to get more aggressive than that. But I'll tell you what, if we're not up to a third sold at these types of profit margins, you know, basis our APH, something conservative, then I think we're kind of missing the point of what the last few years has done. I like to benchmark myself versus last year, benchmark myself versus what August 1st looked like whenever we were looking at new crop prices, because we were well under four at the time, you know, and we didn't know if we were going to make money on 20 or 21. So we don't want to lose sight of what we've been going through these last several years. Quantify, you know, some of our worst case scenarios and, you know, keep flexibility just in case this market gets hot later on.
A third sold for corn. Is that the same for soybean?
Yeah, I'd say it's pretty similar. You know, I think for soybeans at the same time, you could be looking at some pretty wild swings. I guess for me, I have a little more comfort level of getting more aggressive, you know, on soybean sales of this type of, you know, figures that we're looking at, anything over $12. But as I get over a third sold on either corn or beans, I don't have an issue with that. I just want to make sure I'm maintaining quite a bit of flexibility, you know, either through some sort of a long call strategy, you know, or simply putting a floor under the market and maybe leaving myself room to run to the upside.
Hey, thank you.
All right, absolutely.
That's Matt Bennett. He is with AgMarket.net. University of Illinois Extension agronomist Emerson Nafziger has posted an article to the Illinois Crop Central website outlining his early season thoughts on the 2021 growing season. He begins by writing about planting soybeans in March. Nafziger says there's no solid evidence that March-planted beans will yield consistently more than those planted in April, and goes on to write that there's more risk, of course, in planting in March than in April, and little, if any, expected reward to offset that risk. As to which crop to plant first, Nafziger says the forecast is for warmer and a little drier conditions moving into next month. And if that holds true, it makes little difference which gets planted first, corn or soybeans. The decision, he says, can simply be based on which fields are ready first. He also commented on some of the more recent planter technology, including automated planting depth and down pressure, and whether it improves yield or not. He says most modern well-maintained planters do this very well in most soils without add-ons. As for seeding rates, Nafziger says between 34 and 38,000 corn plants per acre often maximizes yield, and that final soybean stand should be about 110 to 120,000 using seeding rates adjusted for conditions and equipment to obtain that population. Yesterday afternoon, the United States Secretary of Agriculture held a 30-minute press conference with about 40 members of the National Association of Farm Broadcasting. Here are some selected highlights. Secretary Tom Vilsack began by outlining yesterday's CFAP 3 announcement from USDA. He says farmers who signed up eligible crops for CFAP 2 will automatically begin receiving the CFAP 3 payments in April, at the rate of $20 an acre for crops like alfalfa, corn, cotton, hemp, peanuts, rice, sorghum, soybeans, sugar beets, and wheat, among others. Again, CFAP 3 payments, $20 an acre, will begin showing up in April automatically for those with crops deemed eligible under CFAP 2. total outlay to these crops will be roughly $4.5 billion to about 560,000 producers. However, Secretary Vilsack says this set of payments from USDA is not primarily designed for program crops.
This really is designed to encapsulate a set of decisions made by USDA that is designed first and foremost to help those a bit more than who have already been helped under the previous COVID relief packages, perhaps provide greater outreach to those who might have been qualified for participation in programs, but didn't know about them or didn't fully participate because they didn't know how to, and also to extend help to many in agriculture and in the supply chain who previous to this had not received any help from COVID relief packages or perhaps received very, very little.
410,000 cattle producers that receive payments under CFAP 1, says Vilsack, will automatically be sent a CFAP 3 payment too. The total remuneration in the range of $1.1 billion. The rates will be published, like all the rest of the CFAP information, on the farmers.gov website at farmers.gov/CFAP.
We also recognized that there were some folks who perhaps were involved in prior COVID packages where the formulation, the calculation may have potentially created a situation where some people wouldn't get the kind of help and assistance that they needed. And for that reason, we're going to basically make some adjustments. I'll give you a couple of examples. There was an opportunity for swine producers and contract growers, poultry, to receive payments, additional payments. The problem was the formula that was used in initial efforts really created a circumstance of inequity between the size of operations. And so we're going to try to smooth that out a little bit and try to make sure that we set up a formula that will allow for adequate resources and help to swine and contract growers. On sales commodities, which are a wider range of products, when we calculated the base upon which your payment would be made, we didn't allow them to take into consideration insurance that they may have received, indemnity payments, NAP payments, or WIP plus payments that they may have received. We think that we should allow them to recalculate, if you will, and we're viewing this process and allowing them to essentially go back in time to basically shore up the amount of loss that they had in fact to sustain so that they get a payment that makes sense.
CFAP 3 contains $6 billion for agricultural interest that were not previously eligible for payments, but that were affected by COVID, says the secretary.
I'll give you an example. A dairy donation program. We recognized during the course of COVID how difficult it was for certain commodities to donate to food assistance. The transition from food service to food assistance was difficult. We're creating resources under a dairy donation program to make it a little bit easier to remove that disincentive for donation in the event we have future problems. We learn from this experience so that we're better prepared in the future. There is an opportunity to reimburse folks who had to euthanize livestock and poultry during this very tragic circumstance. An opportunity to assist timber harvesters and haulers who clearly were hurt and impacted by the COVID. The biofuel industry that obviously didn't receive any help in the previous COVID packages, but yet experienced significant difficulties because of COVID, because of trade, a variety of other issues. Also opportunity for additional resources to help specialty crop producers, beginning farmers, additional resources for organic and urban agriculture as well. Opportunities for us to, in essence, take $6 billion, divide it appropriately and equitably in a way that provides help and assistance to, at all levels, if you will, of agriculture. There'll be additional resources for protective equipment for farm workers and processors and who work in processing facilities. There's an opportunity for even seafood processors to be engaged and involved in this. So it's very comprehensive. We're going to take a look at the resiliency of our food supply system and figure out ways in which we might be able to provide greater resilience. That might be helping processing facilities. It might be looking at ways in which we can expand processing capacity. The opportunity as well for us to help food banks and other users of perishable items in particular, other opportunities for farm to school, restaurants, food banks, a wide variety of folks in the supply chain that are going to be helped and assisted with this effort.
The CFAP discussion encapsulated Secretary Tom Vilsack's opening remarks during the Wednesday press conference with members of the NAFB farm broadcasters. He then went on to questions. I was lucky enough to open this round and question the secretary on remarks he made earlier in the week about pursuing some form of government-backed carbon sequestration to mitigate climate change.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. We appreciate you spending your time with us today. You mentioned this week the CCC might be used to stimulate some form of carbon sequestration. Is this one of the options you plan to present to the president as it pertains to the Tackling the Climate Crisis executive order? And do you have ideas on how that might work?
Well, first and foremost, we're going to make sure that before we formulate any plans, we're going to do what the president has directed us to do in the executive order, and what we would normally do even without the executive order, which is ask for input. So we put out in the Federal Registry a series of questions that we want those in the farming community, those in the forest community to respond to in terms of how we best can help and assist in creating support for climate smart agriculture. The president has set forth a fairly aggressive vision of a net zero emission agriculture by the year 2050. This is incredibly important, I think, for the long-term viability of markets for us, both internationally and domestically. More consumers around the world are demanding proof, if you will, of sustainability. And if America can get to a point where we are operating a net zero emission, we would not only help our climate effort, but I think we will also make our products more marketable in both the domestic and foreign markets. Carbon bank is certainly one of those options, but I would say that any effort in terms of the carbon sequestration or carbon bank has to be designed specifically for farmers. This is not a situation where the existing carbon market system would be particularly helpful. It's very cumbersome. There's a lot of paperwork. It's really not designed for farmers. The credit value is not high enough to justify farmers taking the financial cost that might be incurred in embracing some technologies or some practices. So what we need to do is figure out how we can structure an effort that speaks directly to farmers based on the input that they're going to give to us, and then basically creates the kind of incentive that's of interest to farmers, whether it's basically the ability to have credits sold through a reverse auction process, or whether we have a guaranteed price for credits that provides the incentive for those interested in purchasing the credits, or we have a circumstance where we're essentially funding and financing the improvements on the farm so the farmer's not in a position to have to incur additional expense, or a combination of those factors or some other factor that might make this market appealing. Then making sure that we walk before we run. We're not going to do this in a big, bold, huge way until we know how it might work. So if we do it, when we do it, we'll start relatively small so that we can learn from that experience and build on it so that we have a viable and trusted opportunity if that's what we decide to do. Sequestration is incredibly important. We're not going to get, I don't think, to our national goals without incorporating in some way, shape, or form carbon sequestration in the rural lands that represent roughly 3/4 of the land mass of the United States. Tremendous opportunity for us to increase farm income, create new job opportunities, not just the only way of doing this. I think there's a lot of opportunities to reuse and reclaim methane. I think there's opportunities for us to turn agricultural waste into a variety of different products that creates new revenue streams and lowers the greenhouse gas footprint of farms. I'm excited about this future. I think it's doable. And I think, frankly, the farm community is ready for this if it's structured right and if they feel like they're part of it. And that's what we're focused on doing.
The next question in the queue came from Kara Hart at the Red River Farm Network in North Dakota. She brought Secretary Vilsack back to CFAP 3 asking for clarification on how the government planned to compensate ethanol producers for COVID losses.
Well, that's the reason why we're not in a position today to provide the details, because we're simply announcing that as we look at the allocation of this $6 billion, biofuels and assistance for biofuels will be part of it. Part of that $6 billion disbursement. So that gives an indication to the industry that we recognize that they were left out of previous packages. They won't be left out of this package. We're still in the process of deciding the details of this. We're going to obviously get additional input. We're going to from all factors that will be part of this $6 billion. and then try to make a determination as best we can to provide as much help as we possibly can.
Again, no details on how or how much of the available $6 billion USDA will use to compensate the biofuels industry for COVID-related losses. Farm broadcaster Josh Scramlin in Wisconsin followed up next. He asked if the secretary had any information on the continuing impact of ASF, or African swine fever, on the hog herd in China. The secretary chuckled.
Well, I did actually have a chance to visit with the Chinese Ag Minister earlier this week, and I asked him about the status of African swine fever. Now, this is what he told me. He told me that they have it under control. Now, I would expect him to say nothing different than that. I suspect that what we have is a situation where there are probably some hotspots that are taking place in China. Having said that, the reality is he advised me that the Chinese pork prices are coming down, which would suggest that they are at least are seeing an increase in supply. Now, some of that may be coming from pork they're purchasing, and they are purchasing a lot of pork. Maybe that's the reason why prices have come down for their consumers, but I suspect it's also because a portion of their industry is back online. So I think the truth is probably somewhere in between. They don't have it totally under control, but I don't think it's anywhere near as devastating as it was perhaps 6-9 months ago.
The half-hour-long press conference closed out with a question from Brent Adams of the Fast Line Fast Track, wondering what the Biden administration would pursue under trade policy. Secretary Vilsack had a ready list.
Implementation of USMCA, expansion of the Japanese trade agreement to eliminate the disadvantage we currently find our beef producers under by virtue of the fact that we've sold a lot of beef to Japan early in the year. We're now faced with a tariff that puts us in a disadvantage in that market based on the current trade agreement. Maintaining some relationship with China so that the Chinese purchases continue at pace and pick up so that they are consistent with the phase one responsibility. Looking for opportunities to expand new relationships in the United Kingdom and in Southeast Asia and potentially in Africa. And while we're doing all of that, we need to understand that the secret sauce of trade, in my view, is making sure that we have enough people in these markets giving us the insights necessary for us to understand precisely what those markets need and want from us, and that we basically respond specifically to that. We have enough partnerships with folks and entities in country so that we not only have ourselves being promoters, but more importantly, we have people from that country, from that region promoting U.S. agriculture, and more promotions, more opportunities for us to showcase. And we talked earlier about the sustainability message. We have a good sustainability message today. We'll have a great one in the future. We want to make sure there's plenty of venues, if you will, for the articulation of that of that commitment to sustainability and animal welfare and so forth. So I think that's, in a nutshell, where the focus ought to be.
And those were some excerpts from the National Association of Farm Broadcasting's Wednesday, March 24 press conference held with U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media on this Wednesday afternoon. It is public radio for the farming world.